The Sending of Eight. Prologue. The Discworld offers sights far more impressive than those found in universes built by creators with less imagination, but more mechanical aptitude. Although the disk's sun is but an orbiting moonlet, its prominence is hardly bigger than croquet hoops, this slight drawback must be set against the tremendous sight of great Artuin the Turtle, upon whose ancient and meteor-riddled shell the disk ultimately rests. Sometimes, in his slow journey across the shores of infinity, he moves his country-sized head to snap at a passing comet. But perhaps the most impressive sight of all, if only because most brains, when faced with the sheer galactic enormity of Artuin, refuse to believe it, is the endless rimfall where the seas of the disk boil ceaselessly over the edge into space. Or perhaps it is the rimbow, the eight-coloured, world-girdling rainbow that hovers in the mist-laden air over the fall. The eighth colour is octarine, caused by the scatter effect of strong sunlight on an intense magical field. Or perhaps again, the most magnificent sight is the hump. There, a spire of green ice 10 miles high rises through the clouds and supports at its peak the realm of Dunmanifestin, the abode of the disk gods. The disk gods themselves, despite the splendour of the world below them, are seldom satisfied. It is embarrassing to know that one is a god of a world that only exists because every improbability curve must have its far end. Especially when one can peer into other dimensions, at worlds whose creators had more mechanical aptitude than imagination. No wonder, then, that the disk gods spend more time in bickering than in omnicognizance. On this particular day, blind Eeyore, by dint of constant vigilance, the chief of the gods, sat with his chin on his hand and looked at the gaming board on the red marble table in front of him. Blind Eeyore had got his name because where his eye sockets should have been, there were nothing but two areas of blank skin. His eyes, of which he had an impressively large number, led a semi-independent life of their own. Several were currently hovering above the table. The gaming board was a carefully carved map of the Discworld, overprinted with squares. A number of beautifully modelled playing pieces were now occupying some of the squares. A human onlooker would, for example, have recognised in two of them the likenesses of Bravd and the Weasel. Others represented yet more heroes and champions, of which the disc had a more than adequate supply. Still in the game were Eeyore, Offla the crocodile god, Zephyrus the god of slight breezes, Fate, and the Lady. There was an air of concentration around the board now that the lesser players had been removed from the game. Chance had been an early casualty, running her hero into a full house of armed gnolls, the result of a lucky throw by Offla. And shortly afterwards, Knight had cashed his chips, pleading an appointment with Destiny. Several minor deities had drifted up and were kibitzing over the shoulders of the players. Side bets were made that the Lady would be the next to leave the board. Her last champion of any standing was now a pinch of potash in the ruins of still-smoking Ankh-Morpork, and there were hardly any pieces that she could promote to first rank. Blind Eeyore took up the dice box, which was a skull whose various orifices had been stoppered with rubies, and with several of his eyes on the Lady, he rolled 3 fives. She smiled. This was the nature of the Lady's eyes. They were bright green, lacking iris or pupil, and they glowed from within. The room was silent as she scrabbled in her box of pieces and from the very bottom produced a couple that she set down on the board with 2 decisive clicks. The rest of the players, as one god, craned forward to peer at them.
"A renegade wizard and some sort of clerk," said Offla, the crocodile god, hindered as usual by his tusks. "Well, really."
With one claw, he pushed a pile of bone-white tokens into the centre of the table. The Lady nodded slightly. She picked up the dice cup and held it as steady as a rock. Yet all the gods could hear the 3 cubes rattling about inside. And then she sent them bouncing across the table. 6, 3, 5. Something was happening to the 5, however. Battered by the chance collision of several billion molecules, the die flipped onto a point, spun gently, and came down 7. Blind Eeyore picked up the cube and counted the sides.
"Come on," he said wearily. "Play fair."
The Sending of 8. The road from Ankh-Morpork to Cherm is high, white and winding. a 30-league stretch of potholes and half-buried rocks that spirals around mountains and dips into cool green valleys of citrus trees, crosses liana-webbed gorges on creaking rope bridges, and is generally more picturesque than useful. Picturesque? That was a new word to Rincewind, the wizard. BMGC, Unseen University, failed. It was one of a number he had picked up since leaving the charred ruins of Ankh-Morpork. Quaint was another one. Picturesque meant, he decided after careful observation of the scenery that inspired Two Flower to use the word, that the landscape was horribly precipitous. Quaint, when used to describe the occasional village through which they passed, meant fever-ridden and tumble-down. Two Flower was a tourist, the first ever seen on the Discworld. Tourist, Rincewind had decided, meant idiot. As they rode leisurely through the time-scented, bee-humming air, Rincewind pondered on the experiences of the last few days. While the little foreigner was obviously insane, he was also generous and considerably less lethal than half the people the wizard had mixed with in the city. Rincewind rather liked him. Disliking him would be like kicking a puppy. Currently, Two Flower was showing a great interest in the theory and practice of magic.
"It all seems, well, rather useless to me," he said. "I always thought that, you know, a wizard just said the magic words, and that was that. Not all this tedious memorizing."
Rincewind agreed moodily. He tried to explain that magic had indeed once been wild and lawless, but had been tamed back in the mists of time by the Olden Ones, who had bound it to obey, among other things, the law of conservation of reality. This demanded that the effort needed to achieve a goal should be the same, regardless of the means used. In practical terms, this meant that, say, creating the illusion of a glass of wine was relatively easy, since it involved merely the subtle shifting of light patterns. On the other hand, lifting a genuine wine glass a few feet in the air by sheer mental energy required several hours of systematic preparation if the wizard wished to prevent the simple principle of leverage flicking his brain out through his ears. He went on to add that some of the ancient magic could still be found in its raw state, recognizable, to the initiated, by the eightfold shape it made in the crystalline structure of space-time. There was the metal octyron, for example, and the gas octogen. Both radiated dangerous amounts of raw enchantment.
"It's all very depressing," he finished.
"Depressing?"
Rincewind turned in his saddle and glanced at Two Flower's luggage, which was currently ambling along on its little legs, occasionally snapping its lid at butterflies. He sighed.
"Rincewind thinks he ought to be able to harness the lightning," said the picture imp,
who was observing the passing scene from the tiny doorway of the box slung around Two Flower's neck. He had spent the morning painting picturesque views and quaint scenes for his master, and had been allowed to knock off for a smoke.
"When I said harness, I didn't mean harness," snapped Rincewind. "I meant, well, I just meant that, I don't know, I just can't think of the right words. I just think the world ought to be more sort of organized."
"That's just fantasy," said Two Flower.
"I know, that's the trouble."
Rincewind sighed again. It was all very well going on about pure logic and how the universe was ruled by logic and the harmony of numbers, but the plain fact of the matter was that the disk was manifestly traversing space on the back of a giant turtle, and the gods had a habit of going round to atheists' houses and smashing their windows. There was a faint sound, hardly louder than the noise of the bees in the rosemary by the road. It had a curiously bony quality, as of rolling skulls or a whirling dice box. Rincewind peered round. There was no one nearby. For some reason that worried him. Then came a slight breeze that grew and went in the space of a few heartbeats. It left the world unchanged, save in a few interesting particulars. There was now, for example, a 5-metre-tall mountain troll standing in the road. It was exceptionally angry. This was partly because trolls generally are, in any case, but it was exacerbated by the fact that the sudden and instantaneous teleportation from its lair in the Ramarok Mountains, 3,000 miles away and 1,000 yards closer to the rim, had raised its internal temperature to a dangerous level, in accordance with the laws of conservation of energy. So it bared its fangs and charged.
"What a strange creature," Two Flower remarked. "Is it dangerous?"
"Only to people," shouted Rincewind.
He drew his sword, and with a smooth overarm throw, completely failed to hit the troll.
The blade plunged on into the heather at the side of the track. There was the faintest of sounds, like the rattle of old teeth. The sword struck a boulder concealed in the heather. Concealed, a watcher might have considered, so artfully that a moment before it had not appeared to be there at all. It sprang up like a leaping salmon, and in mid-ricochet plunged deeply into the back of the troll's grey neck. The creature grunted, and with one swipe of a claw gouged a wound in the flank of Two Flowers' horse, which screamed and bolted into the trees at the roadside. The troll spun round and made a grab for Rincewind. Then its sluggish nervous system brought it the message that it was dead. It looked surprised for a moment, and then toppled over and shattered into gravel. Trolls being silicaceous life forms, their bodies reverted instantly to stone at the moment of death. "Ah!" thought Rincewind, as his horse reared in terror. He hung on desperately as it staggered two-legged across the road, and then, screaming, turned and galloped into the woods. The sound of hoofbeats died away, leaving the air to the hum of bees and the occasional rustle of butterfly wings. There was another sound, too. A strange noise for the bright time of noonday. It sounded like dice.
Rincewind?
The long aisles of trees threw Two Flowers' voice from side to side and eventually tossed it back to him unheeded. He sat down on a rock and tried to think. Firstly, he was lost. That was vexing, but it didn't worry him unduly. The forest looked quite interesting, and probably held elves or gnomes, perhaps both. In fact, on a couple of occasions, he had thought he had seen strange green faces peering down at him from the branches. Two Flower had always wanted to meet an elf. In fact, what he really wanted to meet was a dragon, but an elf would do, or a real goblin. His luggage was missing, and that was annoying. It was also starting to rain. He squirmed uncomfortably on the damp stone and tried to look on the bright side. For example, during its mad dash, his plunging horse had burst through some bushes and disturbed a she-bear with her cubs, but had gone on before the bear could react. Then it had suddenly been galloping over the sleeping bodies of a large wolf pack, and again its mad speed had been such that the furious yelping had been left far behind. Nevertheless, the day was wearing on, and perhaps it would be a good idea, Two Flower thought, not to hang about in the open. Perhaps there was a... He racked his brains, trying to remember what sort of accommodation forests traditionally offered. Perhaps there was a gingerbread house or something. The stone really was uncomfortable. Two Flower looked down, and for the first time noticed the strange carving. It looked like a spider, or was it a squid? Moss and lichens rather blurred the precise details, but they didn't blur the runes carved below it. Two Flower could read them clearly, and they said, "Traveller, the hospitable temple of Bel-Shamharoth lies 1,000 paces hubwards." Now, this was strange, Two Flower realised, because although he could read the message, the actual letters were completely unknown to him. Somehow the message was arriving in his brain without the tedious necessity of passing through his eyes. He stood up and untied his now biddable horse from a sapling. He wasn't sure which way the hub lay, but there seemed to be an old track of sorts leading away between the trees. This Bel-Shamharoth seemed prepared to go out of his way to help stranded travellers. In any case, it was that or the wolves. Two Flower nodded decisively. It is interesting to note that several hours later, a couple of wolves who were following Two Flower's scent arrived in the glade. Their green eyes fell on the strange eight-legged carving, which may indeed have been a spider or an octopus, or may yet again have been something altogether more strange, and they immediately decided that they weren't so hungry at that. About 3 miles away, a failed wizard was hanging by his hands from a high branch in a beech tree. This was the end result of 5 minutes of crowded activity. First, an enraged she-bear had barged through the undergrowth and taken the throat out of his horse with one swipe of her paw. Then, as Rincewind had fled the carnage, he had run into a glade in which a number of irate wolves were milling about. His instructors at Unseen University, who had despaired of Rincewind's inability to master levitation, would have then been amazed at the speed with which he reached and climbed the nearest tree without apparently touching it. Now there was just the matter of the snake. It was large and green, and wound itself along the branch with reptilian patience. Rincewind wondered if it was poisonous, then chided himself for asking such a silly question. Of course it would be poisonous. "What are you grinning for?" he asked the figure on the next branch.
"I can't help it. Now would you be so kind as to let go? I can't hang round all day."
"I can," said Rincewind defiantly. The wolves clustered round the base of the tree looked up with interest at their next meal, talking to himself.
"It won't hurt."
If words had weight, a single sentence from Death would have anchored a ship. Rincewind's arms screamed their agony at him. He scowled at the vulture-like, slightly transparent figure. "Won't hurt," he said. "Being torn apart by wolves won't hurt." He noticed another branch crossing his dangerously narrowing one a few feet away. If he could just reach it. He swung himself forward, one hand outstretched. The branch, already bending, did not break. It simply made a little wet sound and twisted. Rincewind found that he was now hanging on to the end of a tongue of bark and fibre, lengthening as it peeled away from the tree. He looked down and, with a sort of fatal satisfaction, realised that he would land right on the biggest wolf. Now he was moving slowly as the bark peeled back in a longer and longer strip. The snake watched him thoughtfully. But the growing length of bark held. Rincewind began to congratulate himself until, looking up, he saw what he had hitherto not noticed. There was the largest hornet's nest he had ever seen, hanging right in his path. His eyes shut tightly. "Why the troll?" he asked himself. "Everything else is just my usual luck. But why the troll? What the hell is going on?" Click. It may have been a twig snapping, except that the sound appeared to be inside Rincewind's head. Click, click, and a breeze that failed to set a single leaf a-tremble. The hornet's nest was ripped from the branch as the strip passed by. It shot past the wizard's head, and he watched it grow smaller as it plummeted towards the circle of upturned muzzles. The circle suddenly closed. The circle suddenly expanded. The concerted yelp of pain as the pack fought to escape the furious cloud echoed among the trees. Rincewind grinned inanely. Rincewind's elbow nudged something. It was the tree trunk. The strip had carried him right to the end of the branch. But there were no other branches. The smooth bark beside him offered no handholds. It offered hands, though. Two were even now thrusting through the mossy bark beside him. Slim hands, green as young leaves. Then a shapely arm followed. And then the hammer dryad leaned right out and grasped the astonished wizard firmly, and with that vegetable strength that can send roots questing into rock, drew him into the tree. The solid bark parted like a mist, closed like a clam. Death watched impassively. He glanced at the cloud of mayflies that were dancing their joyful zigzags near his skull. He snapped his fingers. The insects fell out of the air, but somehow it wasn't quite the same. Blind Eeyore pushed his stack of chips across the table, glowered through such of his eyes that were currently in the room, and strode out. A few demigods tittered. At least Offler had taken the loss of a perfectly good troll with precise, if somewhat reptilian, grace. The lady's last opponent shifted his seat until he faced her across the board. "Lord," she said politely.
"Lady," he acknowledged.
Their eyes met. He was a taciturn god. It was said that he had arrived in the Discworld after some terrible and mysterious incident in another eventuality. It is, of course, the privilege of gods to control their apparent outward form, even to other gods. The fate of the Discworld was currently a kindly man in late middle age, greying hair brushed neatly around the features that a maiden would confidently proffer a glass of small beer to, should they appear at her back door. It was a face a kindly youth would gladly help over a stile. Except for his eyes, of course. No deity can disguise the manner and nature of his eyes. The nature of the two eyes of the fate of the Discworld was this, that while at a mere glance they were simply dark, a closer look would reveal, too late, that they were but holes, opening onto a blackness so remote, so deep, that the watcher would feel himself inexorably drawn into the twin pools of infinite night and their terrible, wheeling stars. The lady coughed politely and laid 21 white chips on the table. Then from her robe she took another chip, silvery and translucent, and twice the size of the others. The soul of a true hero always finds a better rate of exchange, and is valued highly by the gods. Fate raised an eyebrow.
"And no cheating, lady," he said.
"But who could cheat fate?" she asked.
He shrugged. No one, yet everyone tries.
And yet again, I believe I felt you giving me a little assistance against the others?
But of course, so that the end game could be the sweeter, lady. And now?
He reached into his gaming box and brought forth a piece, setting it down on the board with a satisfied air. The watching deities gave a collective sigh. Even the lady was momentarily taken aback. It was certainly ugly. The carving was uncertain, as if the craftsman's hands were shaking in horror of the thing taking shape under his reluctant fingers. It seemed to be all suckers and tentacles.
And mandibles, the lady observed. And one great eye.
I thought such as he died out at the beginning of time, she said.
Mayhap our necrotic friend was loath even to go near this one, laughed Fate. He was enjoying himself.
It should never have been spawned.
Nevertheless, said Fate gnomically. He scooped the dice into their unusual box and then glanced up at her. Unless, he added, you wish to resign? She shook her head.
Play, she said.
You can match my stake?
Play.
Rincewind knew what was inside trees. Wood, sap, possibly squirrels. Not a palace. Still, the cushions underneath him were definitely softer than wood. The wine in the wooden cup beside him was much tastier than sap, and there could be absolutely no comparison between a squirrel and the girl sitting before him, clasping her knees and watching him thoughtfully, unless mention was made of certain hints of furriness. The room was high, wide, and lit with a soft yellow light, which came from no particular source that Rincewind could identify. Through gnarled and knotted archways he could see other rooms, and what looked like a very large winding staircase. And it had looked a perfectly normal tree from the outside, too. The girl was green. Flesh green. Rincewind could be absolutely certain about that, because all she was wearing was a medallion round her neck. Her long hair had a faintly mossy look about it. Her eyes had no pupils, and were a luminous green. Rincewind wished he had paid more attention to anthropology lectures at university. She had said nothing. Apart from indicating the couch and offering him the wine, she had done no more than sit watching him, occasionally rubbing a deep scratch on her arm. Rincewind hurriedly recalled that a dryad was so linked to her tree that she suffered wounds in sympathy.
Sorry about that, he said quickly. It was just an accident. I mean, there were these wolves, and...
You had to climb my tree, and I rescued you, said the dryad smoothly. How lucky for you. And for your friend, perhaps?
Friend?
The little man with the magic box, said the dryad.
Oh, sure, him, said Rincewind vaguely. Yeah, I hope he's okay.
He needs your help.
He usually does. Did he make it to a tree too?
He made it to the temple of Bel Shamharoth.
Rincewind choked on his wine. His ears tried to crawl into his head in terror of the syllables he had just heard. The Soul Eater. Before he could stop them, the memories came galloping back. Once, while a student of practical magic at Unseen University, and for a bet, he'd slipped into the little room off the main library. The room with walls covered in protective lead pentagrams. The room no one was allowed to occupy for more than 4 minutes and 32 seconds, which was a figure arrived at after 200 years of cautious experimentation. He had gingerly opened the book, which was chained to the Octiron pedestal in the middle of the rune-strewn floor, not lest someone steal it, but lest it escape. For it was the Octavo, so full of magic that it had its own vague sentience. One spell had indeed leapt from the crackling pages and lodged itself in the dark recesses of his brain, and apart from knowing that it was one of the 8 great spells, no one would know which one until he said it. Even Rincewind did not. But he could feel it sometimes, sidling out of sight behind his ego, biding its time. On the front of the Octavo had been a representation of Bel Shamharoth. He was not evil, for even evil has a certain vitality. Bel Shamharoth was the flip side of the coin, of which good and evil are but one side. The Soul Eater. His number lieth between 7 and 9. It is 2×4,
Rincewind quoted, his mind frozen with fear. Oh, no! Where's the temple?
Upwards, towards the centre of the forest,
said the dryad.
It is very old.
But who would be so stupid as to worship him? I mean, devils, yes, but he's the soul-eater.
There were certain advantages, and the race that used to live in these parts had strange notions.
What happened to them, then?
I did say they used to live in these parts.
The dryad stood up and stretched out her hand.
Come, I am Drueli. Come with me and watch your friend's fate. It should be interesting.
I'm not sure that... began Rincewind. The dryad turned her green eyes on him.
Do you believe that you have a choice?
She asked.